And welcome back. We will be taking your phone calls next with Dr. Michael Sala as we talk about exopolitics and the things we've been talking about next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to your calls. Dr. Michael Sala, of course, we're talking about Antarctica. Could there be underwater cities and things like that, Michael, or a UFO base?
Underwater cities, I believe that this is one of the things that has also been covered up, that a lot of, I mean, the Earth is, what is it, I think 70% covered by oceans.
Yeah,
and the number of USO sightings have been very steady for many decades. And so there have been people, some of the insiders who have talked about secret space programs, have explained that under the oceans you have major facilities that are used by different extraterrestrial groups, and that this is one of the things that the U.S. Navy in particular puts a lot of energy into tracking the movement of these USOs. So a lot of the kind of very advanced active sonar systems that is deployed by the Navy in the deep oceans, that is designed not to track Russian or Chinese submarines, even though, of course, that's always one application. But one of the major concerns is the movement of these USOs and finding out, you know, what underwater facility do they come from, you know, who does that belong to. These are all important parts of the, you know, the big question over exactly what is under the oceans. Many of these bases are also belonging to the US and other governments around the world, and there are people that have talked about this underground maglev system that can not only travel from one side of the US to the other, but also under the oceans. Richard Sauder, he was one
yes.
of the first people to
talk. The late Richard Sauder, right?
Oh, right. I didn't realize that he passed away recently.
Isn't he? He was the one who investigated, you know, underwater tunnels and things like that.
That's right.
The
yeah,
same
he
guy,
had two
right?
books, you know, dealing with underground bases and also underwater bases. So he was the first one to begin doing the research on this, and he came out with a lot of documents showing you know, where these bases were located, how they were built, and there have been whistleblowers, insiders who have thought, you know, I think Phil Schneider, 1996.
Yeah, you know what, that's who I'm confused with.
Right, yes.
Sauder's still alive.
Right, that's right. I don't want to kill the poor guy off. No. We want him to be around for a long time. He's done a lot of good research on exposing these underground facilities, both under land and under the oceans. And, yeah, that's really one of the aspects of this whole kind of UFO exopolitics phenomenon. It's not just UFO sightings you know, in the atmosphere, but it's also USOs under the water.
Let's take some calls for you. Thomas in La Jolla, California is up with us. Hi, Tom.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call, and I thank you and your staff and the Coast audience for making Coast to Coast the miracle that it is. Michael Sala, I appreciate your work. I loved your work on John F. Kennedy. And the question that I have... I'm reminded of military whistleblower Philip Corso, who after two decades has pretty much been validated. But you were talking about the Space Force, and I'm also reminded of military whistleblower William Mills Tompkins, who unfortunately has recently passed away, wrote the work Selected by Extraterrestrials, in which he contended that World War II was manipulated by extraterrestrial factions, one faction backing Germany, one faction backing the Anglo-American alliance. And he also contended in that book that the Navy took over deep space, secret space programs, late 40s, the 1950s, etc. And how would you assess, I mean, it's been years since he published his work. Do you think, like Philip Corso, that his credibility has improved, that his work has been validated? How would you assess that?
Well, I think his work has been validated to a large extent by people who have come forward since he passed away. I think it was 1997. And he talked about these extraterrestrial technologies that had been recovered and were reverse engineered and, you know, put into the private sector. And he explained that these were things that were being studied by the U.S. military. And, of course, with these different secret space program whistleblowers or insiders that have come forward, you know, William Tompkins being among them, this is something that was only possible because they were able to reverse engineer these captured extraterrestrial technologies. And as you pointed out, you know, Bill Tompkins actually pointed out himself that there was this kind of proxy war happening where different extraterrestrial factions picked different sides in World War II. One helped Nazi Germany and the other helped the Allied powers. And this is something that I think is one of the things about our Earth history that is going to be deeply shocking when people realize exactly what has been happening and that Nazi Germany had received help not only throughout the Second World War, but also in escaping the defeat so that they could continue to operate from hidden bases in Antarctica and South America with the assistance of a group of extraterrestrials that, you know, ultimately I don't think we should regard them as very friendly at all, because obviously they were helping Germany throughout the Second World War, and we know how horrible Germany's policies were, and that's something that one extraterrestrial group continued to do well after the war. So, yeah, I would say that Corso and has been validated, and people like Tompkins have been part of that validation process.
Next up, Mitchell is with us in Seattle, Washington, west of the Rockies. Hi, Mitch. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call, George, and thank your crew and all your people and your guest, Mr. Sulla. I have a kind of a dual-pronged question statement for the first part, and the second part is another question that I'm not sure if either of you guys will know about. But the first part is, listening to your show, I heard about the anti-gravity system that was under development in 1965 that was written about in an aviation magazine by the guy that developed Lear jets, the original Lear. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if he could speak to further developments in the anti-gravity field. And the second part is, are either of you guys, have you looked into the strange lights over China? I think it was October 12th last year, that were like really strange looking things that might have had something to do, in my opinion, with the whole fire and fury thing that Trump was talking about. And by the way, I'm a Trump supporter.
That's okay.
Well, as far as that is concerned, this was something, the first studies that were publicly released occurred in the 1950s. And there were a number of aviation magazines, especially in Britain, that released studies on the feasibility of anti-gravity and how it could be developed for commercial airlines. And so this was something that different aerospace companies at the time were very interested in. We know that that the Douglas Aircraft Company was one of the pioneers in anti-gravity research, and actually William Tompkins released a package of documents from the Douglas years that showed that they were studying anti-gravity, that this was part of their research. And so, you know, this goes back to the 50s. Thomas Townsend Brown, he worked for the Navy and developed, he pitched a particular anti-gravity craft design for the Navy. So in the 50s and 60s, these were being developed, these kinds of anti-gravity technologies. By the 60s, I think that they had their first craft that they were testing and developing. And by the 70s, they started, we're talking about the Air Force, started putting together squadrons of these anti-gravity craft. As far as China is concerned and those strange lights, I mean, China's a very big country. And I know that there have been, the government likes to keep a kind of tight lid on things that happen in China. They don't want Western researchers kind of snooping around down there. And, you know, for example, they keep these pyramids that have been found in China kind of secret. They don't allow Western researchers to go look at them. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that have been found there that the Chinese don't want Western researchers to know about. But I know, as far as UFOs in China are concerned, that there have been a number of US UFO sightings near airports. And there was a famous case where there was an actual landing at a major Chinese airport. And and people actually had an encounter with some human-looking extraterrestrials there that has been also covered up. So, yeah, things are definitely happening in China as well.
All right, let's take a few more calls here. We'll go to Joe in Long Island, New York. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hi, Michael. Two questions. First would be, has some of this stuff already been commercialized, put into wider use, and basically a money-making operation? My second question would be more about the deep state. You were mentioning you're in Hawaii with false flags. And how would you identify the deep state? When I look at, for example, the hydrogen bomb being tested in Bikini Island, and you have a ship with our Army people or Navy people on deck in shorts and sunglasses, and they tell them, oh, don't worry about it. You know, you're not going to get contaminated from the radiation. I see that as like a deep state voice. And I know you were mentioning Hitler. I don't know if he was part of our deep state, that he did escape to South America and became part and parcel of what we do. Or did he relax in the mountains? But I think either way, he got away.
Well, yeah, as far as Hitler's concerned, there are CIA documents that have recently were released as part of the kind of Kennedy declassification. And that's right there. You have a really interesting phenomenon where some CIA files discussing Hitler being found alive in South America, in Colombia in particular, that this was actually classified as part of all of the documents that were not released in association to the Kennedy assassination. So right there you have an interesting question. Well, why did they not want the public to know about Hitler surviving World War II, and why was this linked to the Kennedy assassination? So that's a very interesting question.
Michael, since you've been doing this, and you've been doing it for a long time, what was that first catalyst that got you involved in this?
Well, for me, it was the Disclosure Project press conference that Stephen Greer organized. When I heard the 21 witnesses discuss what they had revealed, I realized that this was something that should be taught at the university level. And that's what I did. I actually did. Only a couple of months after that press conference, I actually showed the video to a graduate class called The Theory of Conflict, Violence, and War. And I was shocked at how conservative the students were, that they thought this was a load of debunk. They couldn't believe that this kind of cover-up could exist. And I realized right there that I was battling very strong headwinds teaching at a university and, you know, putting out this kind of information. But I believed it was real because the people that were discussing their experiences were very sincere and very, very credentialed. A lot of them were professionals in the aviation industry or in corporations or in the military. These were people that were very credible, and I didn't think, you know, especially when you had 21 of them at a press conference all standing up saying, yes, I'm prepared to testify before Congress. You know, these are people that understand that, you know, you can be jailed if you testify and perjure yourself before Congress. So they really believed these things happened, and when I listened to them, I realized this was a cover-up of a phenomenon that really deserved to be studied rigorously at universities. But unfortunately, I guess I was just ahead of my time, and the university wasn't ready for that.
We've got Mary in New Jersey. Go for it, Mary. Hi.
Hello. This is going to sound strange, but I just have this strange thought. When Christ was crucified and the graves opened, and they were raised, and they waited till he was raised, and they all came out, it doesn't tell you. They could have been in that grave for thousands of years. And I'm wondering if they could have all got together and formed a fleet of UFOs. Maybe they knew how to do it. Like, they could have been thousands of years old, these people.
Well, possible, Michael.
Well, yeah, well, actually having a difficulty following that kind of line of thought there, the Christ and his followers were...
Could they have been around for a long time? Could they have been part of an extraterrestrial race?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, the whole kind of Star of Bethlehem, this was actually could have been a UFO.
UFO, absolutely.
That could well have made sense, that Jesus himself could have been a starseed, or actually a baby dropped off by extraterrestrials. And you know, that's not as strange as it sounds, because earlier on in the earlier hour, we talked about this 1989 Defense Intelligence Agency document that Dr. Wood recently verified as being genuine, that it talks about babies being dropped off by the extraterrestrials to help humanity evolve, and that they brought, I think it was, 3 extraterrestrial babies to be raised in human families. And there's stories also that Nikola Tesla, that he was one of these extraterrestrial babies that was dropped off.
He was pretty darn smart, wasn't he?
Right. So then you have to ask yourself, well, was Jesus also one of these people? And you know, and why stop there? Well, you know, could it have been the Buddha? Could it have been others? But certainly, I think, yes, there's a real possibility that some of these founders or these creators of these different religious traditions around the world could have had very strong connections with extraterrestrial races.
Absolutely. Michael, thank you for being on the program. Really appreciate it. Up next, a little bit of Edgar Allan Poe. The Telltale Heart is a short story by the late Edgar Allan Poe, first published in 1843, and of course, we recreated it.
The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe. True, nervous, very, very dreadfully nervous, I had been and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was the sense of hearing acute. I heard all things in the heaven and the earth. I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Hearken and observe how healthily, how calmly, I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain, but once conceived, it haunted me day and night. Object there was none, passion there was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes, it was this. He had the eye of a vulture. A pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold, and so by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man and thus rid myself of the eye forever. Now this is the point. You fancy me mad? Madmen know nothing, but you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded, with what caution, with what foresight, with what dissimulation I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the week before I killed him. And every night, about midnight, I turned the latch of his door and opened it, oh, so gently. And then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a dark lantern. All closed, closed, that no light shone out. And then I thrust in my head. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly, very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me an hour to place my whole head within the opening, so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. Ah, would a madman have been so wise as this? And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, oh, so cautiously, cautiously, for the hinges creaked. I undid it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, every night just at midnight, but I found the eye always closed, and so it was impossible to do the work. For it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning, when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber, and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone, and inquiring how he has passed the night. So you see, he would have been a very profound old man, indeed, to suspect that every night, just at 12, I looked in upon him while he slept. Upon the 8th night, I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watch's minute hand moves more quickly than did mine. Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers, of my sagacity. I could scarcely contain my feelings of triumph. To think that there I was, opening the door little by little, and he not even to dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. I fairly chuckled at the idea, and perhaps he heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly, as if startled. Now you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was as black as pitch with the thick darkness, for the shutters were close fastened through fear of robbers, and so I knew that he could not see the opening of the door, and I kept pushing it on, steadily, steadily. I had my head in, and was about to open the lantern, when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening, and the old man sprang up in bed, crying out, "Who's there?" I kept quite still and said nothing. For a whole hour I did not move a muscle, and in the meantime I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in the bed listening, just as I have done, night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the wall. Presently I heard a slight groan, and I knew it was the groan of mortal terror. It was not a groan of pain or of grief. It was the low, stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul when overcharged with awe. I knew this sound well. Many a night, just at midnight, when all the world slept, it was welled up from my own bosom, deepening, with its dreadful echo, the terrors that distracted me. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt, and pitied him, although I chuckled at heart. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first slight noise, when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been ever since growing upon him. He had been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He had been saying to himself, "It is nothing but the wind in the chimney. It is only a mouse crossing the floor, or it is merely a cricket which has made a single chirp." Yes, he had been trying to comfort himself with all these suppositions, but he had found all in vain. All in vain, because death, in approaching him, had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim. And it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he neither saw nor heard, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a little, a very, very little crevice in the lantern. So I opened it, You cannot imagine how stealthily, until at length a simple dim ray, like the thread of the spider, shot from out the crevice and fell upon the vulture eye. It was open, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it with a perfect distinctness, all a dull blue with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow in my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the ray as if by instinct precisely upon the damned spot. And have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but over-acuteness of the sense? Now I say there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury as the beating of a drum stimulates the soldier into courage. But even yet I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could maintain the ray upon the eve. Meantime, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every instant. The old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder. I say louder every moment. Do you mark me well? I have told you that I am nervous. So I am. And now, at the dead hour of the night, amid the dreadful silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet for some minutes longer, I refrained and stood still. But the beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst. And now a new anxiety seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. The old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once only. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes, the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart and held it there for many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His eve would trouble me no more. If you still think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise precautions I took for the concealment of the body. The night waned, and I worked hastily, but in silence. First of all, I dismembered the corpse. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three planks from the flooring of the chamber and deposited all between the scantlings. I then replaced the board so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out, no stain of any kind, no blood spot, whatever. I had been too wary for that. When I had made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock, still dark as midnight. As the bell sounded the hour, there came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart. For what had I now to fear? There entered three men, who introduced themselves with perfect suavity as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused. Information had been lodged at the police office, and they, the officers, had been deputed to search the premises. I smiled. For what had I to fear? I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I mentioned, was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search well. I led them at length to his chamber. I showed them his treasures, secure, undisturbed. In the enthusiasm of my confidence, I brought chairs into the room and desired them here to rest from their fatigues, while I myself, in the wild audacity of my perfect triumph, placed my own seat upon the very spot beneath which reposed the corpse of the victim. The officers were satisfied. My manner had convinced them. I was singularly at ease. They sat, and while I answered cheerily, they chatted of familiar things. But ere long, I felt myself getting pale and wished them gone. My head ached, and I fancied a ringing in my ears. But still they sat and still chatted. The ringing became more distinct. It continued and became more distinct. I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued and gained definiteness until at length I found that the noise was not within my ears. No doubt I now grew very pale, but I talked more fluently and with a heightened voice, yet the sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much such as a sound a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I arose and argued about trifles in a high key with violent gesticulations, but the noise steadily increased. Why would they not be gone? I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides, as if excited to fury by the observations of the men, but the noise steadily increased. Oh God, what could I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore. I swung the chair upon which I had been sitting and grated it upon the boards. But the noise arose over all and continually increased. It grew louder, 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 and still the men chatted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God! No, no, they heard, they suspected, they knew, they were making a mockery of my horror. This I thought, and this I think. But anything was better than this agony. Anything was more tolerable than this derision. I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die. And now, again, hark! Louder! 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 Villains, I shrieked, dissemble no more. I admit the deed. Tear up the planks. Here! Here! It is the beating of his hideous heart.
I had fun doing that. I really did. It's one of a kind. 1843, Edgar Allan Poe wrote that. For Michael Cosio, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.